Well, as you know, I planned to speak tomorrow, so I had assumed a certain amount of introduction in addition to what Lee said, but I'll try to make up some of that. Oops. Okay, this was work done with a Stanford undergraduate who's now at Princeton, Joe Hanawi. And here's some background. Essentially, I want to discuss the case opposite to what Lee focused on, okay, which is neutron stars accreting in low-mass X-ray binaries. You require a neutron star with a weak magnetic field so the accretion disk can get in far enough to accrete a large amount of specific angular momentum onto the neutron star. I'll keep the analysis general for a while. It could be the R-mode perturbations that we're focusing on, as well as the temperature-induced density inhomogeneities that Lars and others have focused on. Okay, there could be something new, another R-mode revolution maybe, who knows. Okay, so for a while, well, it'll be a general mode. We won't focus on this too much. So the idea, especially for LIGO, you look at the known low-mass X-ray binaries, get their position from the optical and X-ray observations, get the orbital radial velocity, period and phase from the hopefully a companion, okay, depending upon your model, and hoping you can get the spin frequency, which is a big challenge. We'd love to know real spin frequencies. Get the gravitational wave frequency. There's one problem that Patrick and others have pointed out. If this accretion rate m dot varies, which it will, okay, and say it's accreting at Eddington and it doubles or halves, okay, then you lose one cycle of gravitational wave signal in 3 days or more, okay, which is a problem for making your templates. And Patrick will talk about the strategy. Background strategy, etc. So that's sort of an overview of what's motivating this as far as LIGO goes. And I happen to have this along too, which illustrates another thing that Lee was talking about. Here's that characteristic amplitude controlled by the number of cycles you can integrate over, okay, versus frequency for LIGO 1, LIGO 2, and LIGO maybe 3. Here's the R modes that Lee was talking about, evolving from high frequency to low frequency. There's various distances in the newly born neutron stars, and here's what I want to focus on. And so the reason why these are interesting is that if these are in a steady state, converting angular momentum by accretion into angular momentum and gravitational radiation in a steady state, and the gravity wave flux on Earth is proportional to the X-ray flux on Earth, and therefore you look for the strongest X-ray sources, like SCO X1, which depending upon its frequency, which we don't know yet, unfortunately, spin frequency, LIGO 2 may be able to detect, if it's in a steady state. However, what I'm going to show you today is that, at least for the R modes, it will not be in a steady state. Although for Lars's mechanism, it will be. Could be. So that's the main message of the talk today. All right. All right. So consider a fluid displacement. Okay. Where M's the axial mode number, sigma here is the frequency, which was omega for Lee. Someday we'll decide between those two. Okay, I'm looking at M1 equal to zero modes, and I'm focusing now only on low amplitude modes. Okay, lowest order, lowest non-trivial order in the dimensionless amplitude of the mode. Okay. Now, as John and Bernie showed us many years ago in their classic paper, you can at least for a Newtonian equilibrium star, you can that's perturbed in some way, you can write the total angular momentum as the angular momentum of the equilibrium star plus the canonical angular momentum plus this term, okay, plus corrections of higher order in alpha. This motivates us to decompose the total angular momentum into the equilibrium angular momentum, that is the angular momentum if alpha was zero, which is a function of m and omega, plus dimensionless constant, taking account of this, a dimensionless constant times the canonical angular momentum, which we write in this form, introducing our second dimensionless constant, k sub c. So our first basic equation from these papers is that the canonical angular momentum evolves according to this equation, where Fg is the gravitational wave growth rate and Fv is the viscous damping rate, 1 over the time scales that Lee talked about, except I make this guy positive. Okay.
According to this formula, the background story has no angular momentum, has no canonical angular momentum.
Ah, well, No, that's, well, I haven't considered the case of very low omega, okay? So we're not interested in that, so I haven't considered it, actually. That's a good point, though. Have a look. For us, it's just getting the dimensions, right, essentially. Okay, the second equation is just conservation of total angular momentum. The star's angular momentum can only change due to accretion of angular momentum and radiation of gravitational wave angular momentum. So if you combine these two equations, you can get simple differential equations for our first two dynamical variables, alpha and omega. Now, I'm not assuming slow rotation here in general. So we would define this generalized moment of inertia. I'll define it this way, which is not the usual definition, and the specific angular momentum, okay, that's accreted. Okay, the final basic equation is thermal energy conservation. Final of our three equations. Okay. Time rate of change of the thermal energy, right, like this, is increased by viscous heating due to the mode. It's increased by nuclear reactions produced by the accretion of mass, where Kn is of order 10 to the minus 3. It's lost by neutrinos and by photons from the surface. Okay, so this follows the same general structure with some modifications of the paper of Owen Lee et al., where this is the canonical energy in the rotating frame. Okay, so there's another dimensionless constant. Now, I guess Bernie might talk about this, but as I'll come to in a minute, you should allow for two things, the variation of temperature through the star and the variation of temperature with time at different rates in different parts of the star. So conductivities become important in particular. And Joe worked out these numbers, which I haven't checked in detail, just for some thermal time scales. Okay, you can define some thermal time scales, the conductivity time scale, and your various heating and energy loss time scales from this formula. And for the core of the star, I get a conductivity time scale of about a year. And we'll see alpha is of order 10 to the minus 5, if you want a number. So viscous time scale of 100 years. And in the inner crusts, these are the numbers. I'm assuming here from now on, okay, that we're superconducting in the core. Yeah? I think Joe worked it out for 10 to the 8. But I said, I haven't checked these numbers. This is quickie stuff here, okay? There's the viscous time scale again, the nuclear heating time scale, and neutrino loss time scale due to crust neutrino bremsstrahlung off electrons. So there's some time scales which eventually we're going to have to worry about, but here I'm shoving that all onto the table. I'm assuming that there's some instantaneous relation between the temperature characterizing viscosity, where that operates in the star, and this average temperature, which is essentially the core temperature. And there's some relation between the temperature in the crust, where neutrinos are emitted, okay, none from the superconducting core. We're well below the gap energy, is the assumption. And so this is in the spirit of Owen et al. Okay, there's just a one temperature, but this will have to be improved in the future. Okay, we have the usual relation between X-ray luminosity and mass accretion rate, et cetera. Okay, so I emphasize this. So we have two rapidly varying functions, and we have two slowly varying functions. But this is a given function, okay, of what the how fast the companion is dumping stuff on the neutron star. So that's an external specified function, which hopefully we can learn about from the X-ray luminosity to some extent. Okay, so we let zero represent a property of the equilibrium star, and forget about this, except that F sub A is 1 over the time scale for accreting angular momentum, not mass. F sub A, 1 over the time scale for accreting angular momentum. It's important to remember. Okay. Now we go to the main thing I want to talk about. Here. First case, temperature independent viscosity. Okay, so as I said, we assume a superfluid core. And in that case, as Lindblom and Mendel showed, mutual friction between the electrons and the protons in the vortex and the magnetic fields in the vortex lines can dominate the viscosity. In this case, to lowest order, it's independent of temperature, and it varies as omega to the fifth. F sub B is 1 over the viscous damping time scale, 1 over the gravitational growth time scales, proportional, of course, to omega to the sixth for the L equal 2 P modes. Okay? Anyway, okay, so that's what we're assuming from now on. And so we're neglecting a boundary layer. This has not been worked out. Okay? The interaction of a superfluid core with the crust has not been worked out. We're assuming just the initial calculation of Lee as far as that goes. Okay? So there's a lot of uncertainties, which I'll emphasize at the end. And so the basic assumption here is no temperature dependence, as in this case. And then we have this equilibrium omega and mass set by the equality of these two time scales, the gravitational radiation and the viscous time scales, or rates. Okay, so that'll be called F naught when they're equal and when the mode starts growing. Okay, we're going to average over the fluctuations in mass accretion rate, treating it as a constant, and we're neglecting this smaller contribution that comes in. And we combine our basic equations. We get this equation, which Yuri Levin first wrote down, okay, with one important difference. We obtain a minus sign here. Okay. So the equilibrium is unstable and a sense we'll show. Here's the effective potential for the evolution of the amplitude of the mode. Here's the damping function, gamma. Okay, remember all the k's are dimensionless, hopefully, and all the f's have dimension 1 over time. Right? And here's some time scales at equilibrium defined here, right? The growth time scale, if you like, is 10 to the 4 seconds, and the accretion time scale is at least 5 times 10 to the 6 years. This would be the time scale at Eddington accretion rate. This is the angular momentum time scale. So you have this difference here. Angular momentum accretion time scale here. And that's here. Here's the mode growth time scale. Okay, so that's the equation Urey wrote down. Now, we assume mutual friction dominates. If you compare with the 1 over T squared temperature squared dependence of electron scattering viscosity, you find that this wins if this is true. Okay, so we'll assume this is true. We're in the range of omega and T where this is true. So the mutual friction wins. And even if it doesn't, well, okay. Ah, that's an interesting question, which we'll discuss in private. Okay, right? No. But I made an error. I got. You notice mine is a half. Is smaller by a factor of 2, Urey. So, I'd agree. We now agree completely. I think even to this number, which used to be 4, but now it's 2, Urey. But I have a different formalism. So anyway. Okay, so here are the two key timescales. Okay, keep those in mind. Okay, here is the potential that this amplitude is oscillating in. Here's the potential. Units are seconds to the minus 2. Okay, V versus log of the amplitude. So there's the equilibrium quote point, if you like. However, what we did was just start off, we envisioned a star having a very small, we can argue about this, as it approaches the critical point, it has a very small amplitude. We took 10 to the minus 12, okay? So it enters here and then starts oscillating in this potential like this. So there's the equilibrium value of alpha, right? It was just sitting there. So it overshoots by a factor of 10, roughly, as I'll show later, spends about 10% of the time in the overshoot regime, most of the time below. Okay, and there's the time scale, 300 years for the oscillation. Here's how the angular velocity goes. We started at this value for omega. So you get spin up due to accretion until alpha builds up. Then you get rapid spin down due to gravitational radiation until alpha decreases. Then you get spin up again, et cetera, et cetera. And the average increases very, very slowly. Okay, so that's angular velocity, amplitude of the mode. Okay. Here's some handy-dandy formulas if you want them. There's the equilibrium amplitude, which can be at most this value, alpha 0, corresponding to Eddington accretion rates. There's significant overshoot by this factor squared. So it depends on, this is a interesting point, this, the log of the initial amplitude, which is the minimum amplitude reached in the oscillation. Okay, so as I said, it's about a factor of 10 for these numbers. Here's, you can do a lot, you can do a lot of this analytically because we define an energy, of course, from that equation. The energy increases at this rate. This energy, this defined energy increases at this rate. And I'm getting a little ahead of myself. The period of the oscillation, and there's the formula for the period of the oscillation. And there's the fraction of the period for which alpha is above the equilibrium value. Okay? Fraction of the period which alpha is above the equilibrium value. Okay? And there's another formula for the energy. Now, turns out you can find that the fractional, the energy changes by this fractional amount per oscillation cycle. Okay, so here's a number of order one. These are both dimensionless things, although K sub C is about, using Ben Owen's model for the neutron star, K sub C is about 0.09. I think that's true. All right, so it's of order unity. And K sub C prime is almost equal to K sub C. Okay, it's about 0.09. So I'm out roughly alpha max per cycle, okay? Total energy. So this guy's oscillating. So what's going on here? The amplitude's oscillating, right? And this brings in a delicate point, okay? The amplitude's oscillating here, but gradually on this much, so that's a 300 year period, on this longer time scale, okay? which is like this much, let me write it. Right. So in about 10 to the fifth cycles, okay, the energy will e-fold upwards, okay, oscillating this potential, okay, as it slowly moves up. Okay, now, evolution of the temperature under these conditions. Temperature was decoupled from this evolution. How does the evolution affect the temperature? Okay, so we take some initial temperature before the amplitude exists, okay, before the critical point set by the balance between accretion heating and the total luminosity. That gives you the initial temperature, which we'll take here roughly as 2 times 10 to the 8 from Bilson and Brown, et cetera. And for the largest accretion rates, crust neutrino Bremsstrahlung should dominate the luminosity. And that goes as T to the 6th. And the specific heat goes as temperature. Just due to the electrons in the superfluid core. And so that thermal evolution equation reduces to this equation, where T twiddle is our dimensionless temperature. Okay? Dimensionless temperature. FC here is a cooling rate. Okay? FC is the cooling rate given by this time scale. KR is the measure of the rotational energy over the thermal energy, and that's about 10 to the fifth. This number is about 10 to the fifth, rotational over thermal. There's your gravitational wave growth rate, right? There's your cooling rate, et cetera. So there's the simplified equation governing the temperature. And what do we get? I'm sorry, this is a little rough and ready here. I had to make this last night. Take it off a plot. Here's what happens to the temperature. Although these are under somewhat different conditions, sort of the condition that Urey had in his paper, this is just so qualitatively what happens. I'll give you more exact formulas in a minute. So temperature's sitting here. We start at 10 to the 8th here. It's sitting here and sitting here, okay, until you hit the critical curve and the amplitude until the amplitude rises enough. When the amplitude rises enough, and plotted down here is the amplitude again, actually squared. So the amplitude rises, you get heating. Okay, the amplitude's rising, you're getting heating. Here are the two terms in that last equation. Here's the heating rate due to the amplitude. Here's the cooling rate due to the neutrino Bremsstrahlung. This curve is the cooling rate curve. Okay, so the difference is the total amount of heating or cooling. So amplitude rises, you get a lot of viscous heating. It gets so hot, you get neutrino cooling, and then it settles into a quasi-periodic situation again, okay? So that's what we found for one particular model. So now you actually can do more analytic things, it turns out, to estimate this maximum temperature that it reaches, the average temperature it reaches, because we have an analytic form for this, for the amplitude near maximum. And so, thanks. So you can do a lot of, have a lot of approximate fun here. And here's what we get for the average of T twiddle to the sixth during a cycle related to the average amplitude, a dimensionless constant, and there's the two cooling rates. And using this behavior near maximum, you can also get the maximum, an estimate for the maximum temperature over the initial temperature squared, given by this, okay? Now, KR is big, like 10 to the fifth. Alpha max is small, like 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 4, okay? So this is of order 100 case, so we do get about 10 for T max over T initial, not T min. T min's higher than T initial. Okay, so that's that. That's how the temperature evolves. The question is, of course, will the temperature evolve through the superfluid transition temperature? And so mutual friction turns off, okay? I'll come to that at the end. So we're assuming it remains superfluid. Okay, finally, just a quick thing we've started to do. Separate issue. This impacts what Yuri has done for the thermal runaway. Let's talk about a situation where we have evolved in some way. I'm not saying it's natural, but let's just put ourselves at this point, okay? Put yourselves at the equilibrium point and do a stability analysis about equilibrium in the usual way. So what's the equilibrium point? The zeros have a slightly different meaning now, but no matter, some of the zeros. So we look for small deviations from the equilibrium values of our dynamical variables, dimensionless here, deviations. Okay. And then, of course, you get the usual differential equations and the usual determinant, okay, for the eigenvalues or the growth rates or damping rates. Okay, and now, instead of assuming no temperature dependence of the viscous damping rate, I assume it's of order this. And that makes a difference in this analysis. It's very critical to this, okay? So it does not hold if F sub V is small, if this is small, only if it's of this order, okay? So we assume it's of that order, then we get the usual eigenvalue equation, where these are the coefficients of the eigenvalue equation for the growth rates, okay? So there's the order of, all you should focus on is the order of magnitudes here. Remember, F naught is 1/10,000 seconds. KR is 10 to the fifth. Alpha naught is 10 to the minus 5. And this is of order this. Okay, anyway, so there's the general setup. Now, consider this case, okay? Which is certainly true, okay? If the temperature derivative is negative, which it is for all other known sources of viscosity in this temperature range. So assume, but it could be a little positive too, because this, of course, is positive definite. So just assume this, okay? Then all the eigenvalues are real. It turns out they're all real and they're given by this, okay? Okay, now if we require stability, it turns out very simple criterion. If you require stability, this implies that each one of these guys has to be positive. Okay? All right, these guys involve differences, but this guy doesn't. So it resurrects Yuri's criterion, okay, that this must be positive to avoid instability. Okay, otherwise you get a thermal runaway at a rate given by the corresponding eigenvalue, okay, which are estimated here. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about that. And my final u-graph just emphasizes all we don't know again, sort of summarizes neutrino luminosity. There's some subtleties in the crust, of course. Heat capacity. Superfluid transition temperature. Big uncertainties. This is my estimate for the possible range. Thermal conductivities are important, maybe important. Of course, viscous damping rate is the crucial one. The fraction of the accreted mass, rest mass energy that heats the crust. It's been estimated of order 10 to the minus 3. Okay. What is the angular minimum accretion rate? How do you get it from the X-ray observations with enough accuracy to put it into the template? And finally, the relation between what you want, gravity wave frequency and neutron star angular velocity, which will be affected by angular velocity and GR corrections at higher order. So the idea is to embed all this within some parameterized description to try to detect these guys with LIGO 2. Okay, thanks. Yeah. Hi. Yeah, which required a certain inequality, which I have here somewhere. Oh, there it is. So I'm assuming that inequality, okay, which is the, this for R modes, this is all for R modes, okay? For R modes, an ordinary electron scattering viscosity, competing with ordinary mutual friction. No boundary layer, which I want to hear about in the case of mutual friction, right? Magnetic fields, right? That's just putting in your result and the standard result for EE scattering, right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I have an analytic formula, but I haven't actually. That's one thing I got to do is determine how fast that. I, you know, I can give you a rough time scale, but. Okay, wait a minute. Okay. Now, right, so it doesn't change very much, right? Due to the spin up and then the spin down, right? And you can actually estimate that. I didn't have to write down the formulas though. Okay, because you can do a lot of this semi-analytically, yeah. Yeah. That's what I hear. That's what I wrote here. Okay. So I think you're referring to this. So here's what's going on. There's the viscous heating due to the R mode, right? There's the neutrino crust Bremsstrahlung cooling. This is a sketch, okay? This is not a plot, right? This is a plot, actually. This is a sketch. You can see I'm a bad. You could. I don't know. Anyway, these are both rates, at least, okay? They both won over time. The cooling rate, right? And the mode growth rate, right? F0. Right? So here, actually, you can do this analytically because you get a big input here, and this part of the curve you can do analytically, so I can integrate that equation and get those estimates, okay? That's the way I got the estimates, okay? And you can check that it's okay. That it's just this pulse, heating pulse. Okay, dominates. I've neglected cooling in those estimates, in those analytic estimates. I've neglected cooling in estimating T max. Okay, so T max is mostly just from the heating blip. Okay. Yeah, alpha. Here's where alpha starts to get large. Okay, and here's where alpha starts to get small. Right, and that's short 10% of the cycle. Right, when alpha's large. That's when the heating occurs. Right. 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 And you did that, and but you did it for low accretion rates, and I'm trying to scale it to a 1,000 times greater accretion rate. So you got 3 × 10⁴, roughly. Sorry, 3 × 10⁹, for the superfluid case, which I happen to have here. Okay, let's address that one. So here's what you got for a low accretion. Here's what you got for R-mode heating for a low accretion rate, right? I was trying to scale this last night, but I failed. So we want 10⁻⁸ solar masses per year, okay? Say, right? Okay? So how much higher will this be? Well, factor two, maybe. Factor two, maybe. I guesstimated roughly a factor of two. You got 10⁶ for the cooling, et cetera. So, well, we got it all here. You can see how it scales. Yeah, that's this curve here, right? What they did for the superfluid case, right? These are guys that have turned off their accretion, so you can see the surface, okay? You can see the surface and get an estimate. So this is a problem, except that we have to look at the minimum temperature, but remember, 90% of the time, okay, you're not heating, okay? 90% of the time, you're not heating. So you're at T-min, which was roughly, from the other view, T-min was a few 10⁸, just from the balancing, okay? Just. No, we got the time, cooling time scale is less than the period of 300 years. That's what our calculations gave us. As you see from the curve of temperature, the cooling time scale was somewhat less. Things are all over. Somewhat less than the period. That's what we got. Essentially, we assume it's heat as a whole, okay, throughout the core, essentially, which is most of the star, okay, and maybe the inner crust. Maybe the inner crust, but it doesn't matter for these estimates, okay? It's most of the star. Mm-hmm. It all comes from the crust neutrino brownstone. The heating's in the core, right? And this is the problem. The heating's in the core, et cetera. Neutrino emissions from the crust neutrino brownstone, okay? That's where the cooling comes from, the inner crust. The heating comes from the core and maybe the inner crust, right? So you've got conductivities, I said, to worry about. You've got transport time scales to worry about that we haven't done yet, right? Right. Yeah? Nope, because, just say it in words, with the calculation we did, the FDT had to be less than a positive number, okay? So if it's small and positive, that analysis still holds, okay? Right? And it's unstable. If it's small and positive, okay, the analysis holds and shows it's unstable if the FDT is much less than F over T, okay? Oh, I'm sorry, it can't be much, it has to be order F over T again, okay? So if it's order F over T and positive, okay, but less than that thing, which I can't find. Should be here somewhere. Then should be all right. Oh, it's gone, so. So another question while I look. Here it is. So in this case, if the FDT is small but still of this order and positive, it's unstable, okay? Right? Because this criterion has to be small, okay? It could be small and positive, okay? And satisfy this criterion, in which case it would be unstable, right? So this says a small, even small positive guys, would satisfy this criterion, it would be stable if it was small and positive, it would still satisfy this criterion, okay? So small positive guys, but not, okay, could satisfy this criterion, depending upon the signs of these guys, okay, which depends upon the cooling rate, okay, and the heating rate, okay? So you have to evaluate the signs of these guys as well as the sign of that one, right? Yeah. Yeah, but it's 10%, which isn't too bad. Not too bad. I avoid Greg's problem, you see, sometimes for these guys, and yet I guess some guys are. Yeah. I promise I wasn't. Well, here's a little subtle point that I mentioned I'm worrying about this subtle point now. Look at this thing. Okay, you start at some initial amplitude that God gives us, right? 10 to the minus 12, whatever, right? But then you oscillate, you build up, and your minimum becomes smaller. Your minimum amplitude gets smaller with time. What the hell does that mean? Does that mean this will stop the increase in energy and it will sit here? That would be nice. I don't know, okay? Yes. Hopefully something excites it with a big enough one so it's well above the background, right? That's what I hope. So you can choose your initial amplitude. We took it, so some people like 10 to the minus 6, or in which case you're down here near the minimum, okay? But the duty cycle's still the same. You notice that formula was, well, it did depend on alpha min logarithmically. A lot of logs of alpha min come in, it's essentially. Okay. Thank you.